This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, great seeing you. We know some time has passed because you're wearing a vest, so we've entered the fall in Maine.
We have. It's the weather. Fall is my favorite season in Maine because, first of all the tourists leave. And as much as we love all of you coming to visit us in the summer, it gets crowded and there's traffic. It's kind of like Los Angeles. So we like it when people leave. And the leaves change color. I sent you a photo of a beautiful fall hike I took this weekend. And when that couple of days when the foliage really pops and you get like that peak bright red leaves and orange and yellow, it's just really beautiful. So it's a nice time to be here.
It's great.
Just don't come.
Well, I'll tell you, the fall here in LA looks the same.
I see you've got your Buffalo Bills hat on.
I did. I did that just for you. I am sorry that you're on your third quarterback right now. That's not good. I was rooting for you guys now that Tom's off the team.
Not only is Tom off the team, but he's off his other team too, it looks like. I don't know what's going on with that.
It's not looking good.
It was the dream couple.
It is not looking good.
Now, no longer.
It's crazy.
I hope that doesn't happen to us.
It definitely will not. It will not. Goodness. So we have a special edition of our podcast, and Ben, you and Meryl pull in. Meryl, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm a big Elevate fan, so this is a career dream of mine.
She's paid well to say that, by the way.
Well, I'm serious.
We're excited to have you on.
Thank you.
And we're having this because in Androscoggin County in Maine, you two were in trial and got a $5.5 million verdict on a $7,900 offer.
You know, I misstated it. It was $7,500.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I was so shocked with the 7,900 number with the level of precision that they added that $400 to the offer amount. But a $7,500 offer and for Ben, when was the last time you were in trial in Maine? Things were really shut down over there.
Right. We haven't had any civil jury trials scheduled in our state since 2019, I believe. The last trial I did was a medical malpractice case in Bangor, Maine, which I think was in 2019. And it was one of the very last jury trials we had before the pandemic. And since then, we've really been banging on the door of the judiciary, trying to get them to give us some love and allow us back in the courtroom. And that has just now started to happen. So the very first civil jury trials, I mean, there were a couple one-offs here and there, 1 or 2 day trials, sort of back up to criminal dockets. But in terms of scheduling real cases for trial, it just started this summer. I think the first trials were in the July, August timeframe. So for us, getting in September was really right on the front end. I know that sounds weird in your world where you guys have been trying cases now for well over a year, I think, but that's how it's been up here.
So I have a host of questions, but first and foremost, tell us a little bit about the case and the trial presentation.
This is might end up being our Halloween special, and I'd like to now cue the Halloween, the eerie Halloween music. And I think I'll turn it over to Meryl and let her tell you kind of the basic facts of the case. Meryl, first of all, she's an associate at our firm, and she was the lead lawyer working the case up through discovery from the very beginning, working with the clients. She took virtually all the depositions. And at trial, we split it up. She did the opening, and she put on both of our client and her sister, who are kind of our principal damages witnesses, and also our PhD psychiatrist. And I did the voir dire and the liability case. I put on the defendants and their employee, and also did the close and rebuttal close. So it was actually I've never tried a case that way before. I've never done a trial where I didn't do the opening myself. Basically, I've always done everything myself, with a little, few exceptions of maybe letting somebody take one witness or something. But this was really a team effort. Meryl did a wonderful job at trial communicating our damages claims and working with our clients. Their testimony was very compelling, and I think it's one of the reasons we did so well. But Meryl, why don't you just tell us kind of what the background facts are of the case? And then we'll cue the Halloween music.
So there was one individual plaintiff whose case was tried. Her name was Marielle Bischoff Wurstel. Marielle's dad, Bruce Wurstel, was sent to this funeral home for cremation in the very end of May of 2021. He was basically left at the funeral home for over 2 weeks in the basement while his body decomposed there. The family was essentially blown off by the funeral home, save for one phone call the family was able to make, or where they connected with someone from the funeral home in the middle of that 2 weeks. And they were misled into believing that dad was fine, his body was refrigerated, and that the funeral home was going to get the job done. Of course, that was not true at all. And Marielle, about 17 days after her father's body was picked up by the funeral home, was scrolling through her Facebook page and came across a news media video detailing how the funeral home had been shut down and how what had been found in the basement were 11 to 12 decomposing bodies, reddish brown fluid on the floor flowing into a drain, and an odor of decomposition so strong that it gave a state investigator a headache. And that's how she learned about what was really going on at the funeral home. Of course, the story continues to unfold in the news for weeks and months after that point, which brings to light the fact that the director of the funeral home had not been coming into work at all throughout 2021. Of course, when this all goes down is early mid-June of 2021. So by that point, he's been blowing off work for over 6 months. He'd had some prolonged absences going back into 2020, but the real problem started in 2021. And because he wasn't coming in, cremations couldn't be completed. So this funeral home just kept picking up bodies and letting them sit in their basement. Ben elicited some testimony at trial from an assistant, a part-time assistant, part-time employee from the funeral home, who said that the director instructed him to keep picking up bodies because I need the money. It was horrific.
So at the time of trial, what were the claims, and then what were the defenses?
I think teaching points of this case is that the defense obviously understood there was no defense to the conduct that they were involved in, similar to your case, Rahul, involving the beer line fluid, cleaner fluid. So they smartly, like your case, thought on the eve of trial that we are going to stipulate to liability. But that was problematic for us because our claim was not based on, so the, just by way of background, probably many of our listeners know that generally in tort law, there's a rule that says you can only recover for emotional distress damages if you have an accompanying physical injury. And there are limited exceptions to that for certain categories of claims. One of the standard categories is bystander liability. But to be a bystander, you have to be sort of within a zone of danger and have contemporaneously observed the harm that was caused to your close loved one. This case doesn't subscribe to any of those things because, as you heard from Meryl's description, our client, she never went to the funeral service establishment. She never saw her father in his state of decomposition in the basement. Her only knowledge of the events came from essentially the news media who were reporting on this. And so the question is, what kind of claims can be brought under those circumstances, or does tort law even recognize claims? You may recall from law school that there was sort of a famous case that also comes out of Maine, since we're very proud of this, called Gammon versus Osteopathic Hospital of Maine, in which the hospital mailed a severed limb to a relative of the decedent by mail. And the decedent, the family member opened the mail and saw the limb and was obviously quite distressed by that. And the holding in Gammon is that there are exceptions to the rule that you require physical injury or bystander in order to obtain emotional distress for certain categories of egregious conduct, which include the mishandling of remains. So for cases involving mishandling of remains, one can recover for emotional distress absent physical harm or injury. And where I'm going to circle back is, so what they were trying to do is stipulate to liability, but we were not pursuing ordinary negligence claims. We were pursuing negligent and intentional infliction of emotional distress claims based on the precedent of Gammon and mishandling of human remains. And one of the elements of those claims is that you not only have to prove the negligence or the intentional slash reckless conduct, but you also have to prove that that conduct was such that it would likely cause severe emotional distress to somebody of ordinary sensibilities. So the conduct itself is relevant to its propensity to cause that type of distress. So we resisted their attempts to stipulate to liability because we said that's inextricably intertwined with our damages claims because of the type of claim we brought. And the court agreed with us. First of all, said we can't have a stipulation here because the plaintiffs don't agree and it takes two sides to stipulate. Once the defense lost that, they then filed what they called a formal concession into the record, essentially conceding liability. Now, I'm not even sure what that is. I'm not sure there's any legal standing for that type of thing, a formal concession. What does that mean, right? We have the burden of proof, and the jury could disregard that. It has no legal force or effect, which we made that point. But the goal of the defense was to say, look, we're conceding all the liability issues. They even went so far as to say they would concede that their conduct caused serious or severe emotional distress because they knew that was an element of the claim and they wanted to get rid of all of our liability case. And then they wanted to make Rule 403 arguments that because they were conceding, now all of that evidence of conduct was unduly prejudicial.
Irrelevant.
But the court rejected that, I think rightly so, and said, look, these guys pled these causes of action. The causes of action require them to prove these elements. And short of evidence that becomes cumulative or violates Rule 403, and we'll take it one issue at a time, I'm going to permit the plaintiff to tell the story of the case and to try their case. And That was really, really important for us because there are cases certainly where you could get a stipulation and it wouldn't take away the force of your underlying case. I think in this case, it was very important for the jury to understand the context and the story of what happened here in its entirety.
So this formal concession or the position the defense was taking, did that still bear out at trial? Did the defense still try to make that presentation or argument without any witnesses that they agree with everything that's been presented?
They did. And so we knew they were going to do that. In the opening, they came right out of the gate and said, basically, we agree that what we did was wrong. There's no excuse for it. We take full responsibility for it. Of course, and then they proceeded to try to dismantle our damages claim and attack our client in terms of the severity of basically that suggesting she was exaggerating her claim and things that, of that sort. We thought a lot about how do we deal with the argument that they're conceding liability. And I came up with an approach that I used in closing, and I can share it with you. I can say that I think it went well. Everybody who heard it responded favorably with one exception, and that was my wife, who had come to listen to the closing argument. You'll see in a moment why she didn't respond well to it. So we did a lot of things with it, but so this is the way this argument went. And I prefaced it by saying, you know, I've been giving a lot of thought to this and how to talk about this idea that they've conceded liability. And I came up with this analogy. I said, I want you to imagine that you have a husband and wife, and the husband has been cheating on his wife with another woman for 5 months. One night, the wife comes home unexpectedly and finds her husband in bed with another woman. And after that, the husband says to his wife, honey, I accept full responsibility for what I did. What is he really saying? What he's really saying is, I got caught, and I want you to go easier on me. He didn't accept responsibility. He got caught. And there was no denying what he did. In our case, the evidence of guilt was overwhelming. So when they say they accept responsibility, what they're really saying is they want you to go easy on them. They want a discount. Why should you give them a discount? What did they do to earn a discount? And we did a whole thing about how they didn't ever accept any responsibility or try to fix the problems during the time that they continued to get away with it. It was only after the state came in and found the problems and shut them down, right? During the entire time, I mean, they had some of the bodies in their basement for over 7 weeks rotting down there. They never once called any of the families and said, we're sorry, we just can't complete the work. Why don't you transfer your loved one to a different service? Or even, let's stop taking more bodies now because we know we can't complete the cremations. They just kept doing it. And the truth is they would have kept doing it forever if someone hadn't intervened and stepped in and shut them down. So don't give me this nonsense about accepting responsibility. And that was kind of the theme of how we dealt with that. I know that after that part of the closing, my wife had to leave and she missed the rebuttal, but on her way out, she was leaving with my partner. And she said, I really like Ben's closing, except for that analogy about cheating on his wife. But I kind of thought it sort of drove home the point, you know, and we can get feedback on whether people like it or not, but that was kind of how we tried to deal with that.
That is an amazing analogy. Never even thought about it that way until you said it. So really, it connects to the issues in your case. Just out of curiosity, were you thinking about any other analogies that...
For the conceding point, I don't think so. No, I mean, do you have one?
No. It's just, I don't know. Like, that's always a dicey thing.
What I was trying to convey with that, because this guy, as Meryl said, he had sort of been skipping out on work. By the time they picked up our client's dad, he hadn't really been doing his job for about 5 months. So that's why I used the 5 months of cheating on your wife. So for 5 months, he had been getting away with it too, right?
Right.
But, you know, I mean, I've heard other people do, like the kid with the cookie jar. You know, you walk into the kitchen and the little boy has his hand in the cookie jar and says, "Mom or Dad, you know, sorry, I'm taking responsibility for stealing the cookie." But not really. He's just getting caught for stealing the cookie.
Right.
But I just didn't think that was nearly as powerful as the one that we tried.
I agree.
And the jury seemed to respond well to it. I didn't get any negative body language. But I thought it was important to preface it. I did preface it by saying, you know, I'm sorry if this analogy offends anybody. It's the best. I said it's the best I can come up with.
So on the theme of them conceding or accepting responsibility, and with each of your witnesses, was there something that you did or tried to do to jam that down their throats? Did they even cross-examine your experts or on the liability issues?
Not so much on liability, but we tried to kind of create the nexus between the conduct and the effects, the emotional harm it caused to our client. We did that through both our client herself, Mary Ellen, and also through the psychiatrist. Meryl, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Well, to answer your original question, I mean, did they try to bring up in cross-examination of our client or our damages witness this idea of the concession? You know, one of the really great moments, I think, of the damages case was that our client, who we put on last, brought up in one of the newspaper articles that she read in the aftermath of what had happened that the director is quoted as having the feeling that this was not a big deal. And she stared right at him in that moment as she read that line from that article. It was very powerful because it did highlight that, in fact, they really hadn't done anything to concede liability. Certainly the director had not. But we did really try, you know, that's a good example of how we tried to connect the conduct with the emotional distress. With Marielle, we went through a lot of, you know, basically chronologically, we went through how she learned about this, how it played out in her mind. You know, one of the, I think, really powerful pieces of this was around the time the family learned about all of this, they also learned that the office of the chief medical examiner in Maine had come in and retrieved all of the bodies that were there when the funeral home was shut down, brought them up to the medical examiner's office and started contacting the next of kin for those bodies. Of course, our client was one of those people. And in the process of those phone calls, the medical examiner's office was telling the next of kin, and, you know, we think we have your loved one. In this case, the medical examiner called and said, we think, you know, we have your father's body. And there was a discussion about identifying the remains. And Marielle, under the impression that she needed to do that, Googled what parts of the body remain after being unrefrigerated for 2 weeks, because she literally had this vision in her mind that her dad was not going to be identifiable because he was so decomposed. And we really tried to, I think, focus on that. You know, the defense really wanted to make the damages case about these people were sad anyway. They just lost their father. The plaintiff in particular was a young woman and she'd never experienced a loss of a family member. And I think that made it all the more important for us to focus with our damages witnesses, particularly the plaintiff, on the grotesque imagery that this triggered for her, rather than extended sadness, if you will.
Yeah, your summary of the case gave me a visceral reaction, and it just in the pit of my stomach, thinking and just trying to imagine what the family was going through and what was actually happening in that facility. It's awful. That's awful. Why did they cross-examine the plaintiff, suggesting she was exaggerating if they already agreed she suffered severe emotional distress? That just seems crazy.
It's a really good question. They did have some stuff to work with. You know, I think Marielle early on was, and she really is a person, I think, having worked with her throughout the life of this case, who wanted to just say, I'm fine. Everything's fine. I just want to keep marching forward with my life. But as she turned towards this more and more, a part of it was getting ready to go to trial. She started to have this, I mean, it just, things just got worse and worse after that point. But it is interesting why they wanted to cross-examine her on that if they were conceding that it was serious and severe emotional distress.
They gave that with one hand, but then took it away because they challenged all of the evidence that she had emotional distress at all, really. And there, like Merrill referenced, there was one document that they kept going back to, which was when Marielle was first evaluated by the forensic psychiatrist, he had asked her to fill out a series of forms that were self-reporting her condition. And she understated the severity of her condition in basically every answer. I mean, the questions would be, do you feel sadness? And her answer would be no. Do you have any problems, you know, interacting with other people? No. So basically, in response to every question, she put the least or one of the least severe choices, which would have suggested she was absolutely fine with no problem at all. And they continued to use that document both in crossing her and crossing our psychiatrist. And the truth is that those documents obviously aren't great for us. Marielle filled them out herself, and they asked her whether it was true or not, you know, and it's either not true, which doesn't look great, or if it's true, it isn't great. So there were issues with that. But I think Marielle was on the stand for probably about an hour in direct. Merrill did a great job with her. And by the time she was done, the jury saw who she was. And actually, Merrill had previewed the issue of the forms in her opening by saying that what you're going to learn about Marielle is, you know, just what Merrill said, that she's the kind of person who doesn't like to talk about this. It's very hard to draw her out. Her instinct is just to say everything is great, everything is fine. And then in the closing, they went back to that again, and they essentially accused our psychiatrist of exaggerating the case and cherry picking the symptoms because, you know, what he said was these forms were important, but then ultimately he concluded that the emotional distress was significant based on his interviews, his lengthy interviews of our client. He interviewed her twice, probably for a total of in the range of about 4 hours. And I just pointed out, first of all, that the defense lawyer here seemed to be arguing that our client, I mean, we couldn't tell what he was trying to say. Is he saying that she's exaggerating her symptoms and lying about them? And I said, if so, don't you think the sleazy lawyer who sent her to the sleazy psychiatrist would say, hey, Marielle, when you fill out those forms, make sure you put the worst possible symptoms down for each answer, right? If it's a 1 to 4, you got to put a 4 down for every one. You got to exaggerate. Make sure you exaggerate, Marielle. But actually, she did the opposite of that, right? She was honest about it. She had a hard time talking about it. But in this courtroom, and then, you know, the psychiatrist spent 4 hours with her. That's 2 to 3 times as much time as you've heard from her in this courtroom. And I knew how compelling her testimony was. And you could think of the psychiatrist sitting there hearing that. And of course, he's going to come away concluding that she qualifies for the diagnosis that he rendered. Anybody would, right? So I just think it was, you know, it was a difficult obstacle in terms of her case that we had those forms and that we had that. Also, her early deposition was not good for us because just like the forms, it was very early on in the process and she tended to understate everything. She didn't provide all the detail that came out later. But knowing that that was going to be an issue, we had a plan for it. And I think we were able to overcome that.
That's a textbook example, or it should be in a textbook at least, of how to approach a bad fact like that and really kind of face head on the dog whistling with the defense argument and the suggestion that it's really just a lawyer-driven argument when it's really not. That's amazing.
Yeah, and you know, I think the voir dire, I mean, as somebody who doesn't get the opportunity to do voir dire like you guys do out west very often, and we could talk about that, but having developed the relationship with the jury in voir dire, I felt a lot more comfortable saying things like, you know, the sleazy lawyer is going to do this, because I felt like we had a connection enough that they knew that that wasn't who I was. I don't know if Meryl agrees with that, but I felt good because we're very upfront in voir dire about what the case was about and what we're going to be asking for. And
one of the ways, Ben, I think one of the topics that you got to question potential jurors on in voir dire was this idea of emotional distress damages and awarding money for solely emotional distress damages. And I think it was in that moment, and that this was probably midway or even beyond midway through your voir dire, that you had jurors really starting to engage with you, if not verbally, certainly non-verbally. You had some people leaning forward going, yeah, you know, emotional distress is real. And you had other people going, no, shaking their heads in the back. And I think, Ben, I mean, I think you should highlight this part. We really had to, I think in your closing, you did a really, really nice job highlighting the difference between physical injuries and emotional injuries when it comes to our understanding of them and how we value them. That was always going to be a very big hurdle in this case, getting people to value emotional injuries in the same way that they might value physical injury.
Yeah, one of the interesting things in voir dire was there was a retired physician. Remember him? He was sitting in the front row in the middle.
Yeah.
So I was very direct in the opening. I said, you know, we're going to be asking you to return a verdict of at least $5 million in this case. And the only damages that we're claiming are emotional distress. So I want to understand if there's anybody here who, even without hearing any of the evidence, just doesn't think that that's something they could consider. In a response to a question like that, this doctor raised his hand and he started talking about practicing medicine and how there were a lot of insurance claims. I didn't really understand where he was going with any of this. But at one point he said, you know, we in medicine understand that emotional distress or psychic injury is real. It's a real thing. A lot of people question it, but, you know, but his whole, there were so many wild card facets to his response that ultimately he ended up being excused for cause, I believe. But I think we challenged him, maybe the other side did, but I think it was kind of everybody agreed that there were too many weird answers there, that it wasn't clear where he was going with that. But I did like that part, because he did for a few minutes as a physician talked about how, you know, emotional distress they're real damage, they're real issues. And in the closing, again, this was the center of our case because we didn't have any physical injury. And what I said was something to the effect of, there may have been a time in our history where if you broke your arm or you broke your leg, that's real because a doctor can see that when they look on an X-ray. But if you have a broken heart, if you are plagued with anxiety, depression, grief, withdrawal, emotional distress, that you just you're just a fragile person with a weak constitution. And I said, in Maine, we have a saying for people like that. And I said, you know, just suck it up, buttercup. And so I said, but I hope we've come a long way since those days. And I hope that we recognize now that emotional trauma, emotional injury are just as real as physical injury. probably many of us in our own lives, I know I have dealt with these issues, and we know how real they are. And while there might be, and they might even be worse and more harmful than physical injuries, because while a broken arm or a broken leg is going to heal, a broken heart may not. So we kind of took that head on and went to try to illustrate the point, because I think everybody now understands this. And there's not, you know, how many people do you know, Rahul, who sometime in their own lives or in the lives of their families don't deal with at least one of these issues? And you know how devastating it is, even just a simple depression diagnosis, you know, or anxiety disorder or whatever it is. I mean, those things are, they affect every aspect of your life. So I think as trial lawyers, we've kind of we've been trained, we've grown up with the concept that everything is built off of the physical harm. And then the emotional distress is kind of the add-on to that, the ancillary thing that happens as a consequence of the physical harm. Well, you also have emotional distress. But if you have a case where you only have that as your element of damages, where there is no physical harm, it sort of focuses your mind on, you know, maybe we've been underselling that element of damages for a long time. We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, National Court Reporting Service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
So one last question on how the closing went, and then I've got a couple of others I want to ask you leading up to the trial. What did the defense argue and request that the jury award to your client?
The defense, I think, was, I think my feeling about it, watching it all happen, was that they were caught off guard by some of the strategy Ben employed in asking for money, because as Ben has pointed out, not only was there no physical injury, there was no economic loss whatsoever. So asking for $5 million or at least $5 million was going to be, you know, we were going to have a hard time asking or providing a framework to the jury for that ask. But Ben had some good strategies, and I think it caught the defense off guard. And the defense's response was, I'm not going to give you a number. I'm not going to suggest a number. And I can't remember why he said he wasn't going to, except to do the old song and dance of, that's exclusively your province, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. That's only for you to do. It's not like, in other words, it's inappropriate for the plaintiff to have suggested a number to you. And it's so inappropriate that I don't dare to suggest a number to you out of deference to you. But outside of that, your other question was, what did they argue? They nitpicked. The defense spent virtually his entire closing argument nitpicking the damages witnesses and pointing out how, in addition to, of course, reiterating that they take responsibility, just pointed out how the plaintiff's older sister, who was a damages witness, was embellishing, that what she testified to at trial was slightly worse than what she testified to in her deposition, and how Marielle, in her self-report questionnaire and in her deposition, was understating, and how our forensic psychiatrist added up the numbers wrong on the self-report questionnaire, and how Marielle didn't have depression. And it was just an hour worth of nitpicking. And Ben's rebuttal was such a great response to that.
How did you attack that, Ben?
Well, so the very first question I asked in voir dire was, I actually used some of the questions that John Campbell had introduced me to gauge where jurors were kind of on the spectrum of civil justice. So I said, I had it on a flip chart, but one side is the Constitution. We have a constitutional right to bring these kind of claims, and it's important to use those when needed. And on the other side was, these kind of cases are invented by lawyers to make money. And I asked the jury which side they felt a little bit closer to. And, you know, we had a discussion about that. Most of the jurors opted for the constitutional side, but I got a couple to say they agreed with the other sentiment. We had a discussion about it. But at the end of it, we didn't select anybody for the final jury who didn't agree more closely with that this was a constitutional right that people should take advantage of when they need it. So when I got up for the rebuttal, I said, you know, everybody sitting here agreed that this is an important constitutional right that we should all have a ability to take advantage of when we need it. And I said, but let me tell you something. Trying to exercise that right comes with a great cost. And you've seen that play out just now. Because what they will do to you if you try to exercise that constitutional right is what they just tried to do to my clients here in this courtroom right now. They will twist your words. They will take hundreds of pages of testimony and try to pull one or two statements out of context. And then they're going to call you an exaggerator. And I said, he called the sister. He said she was biased. And I said, that's her sister, for God's sakes. And right at that moment, the sister was crying in the courtroom loudly. It was powerful because she's biased. I mean, she's her sister, you know? And for the psychiatrist, you know, our psychiatrist said that one of the reasons that drew him, I think it was a great question Merrill asked him during his direct. So why did you get into this line of work? He said, well, because I lived in New York on 9/11 and there was a lot of need for grief and trauma counseling. And I just became focused on learning about that. And that became a big part of his career. And he said, also, as I got into it, I learned that, well, I knew my parents were Holocaust survivors. And I think I had a connection to this work, the trauma, the grief, because of that. And then in their closing, they said, well, you know, this guy they hired, he focuses on trauma and grief in his career, you know, and there's an old saying that when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. You know, this guy is just, you know, he sees grief or trauma in everybody, apparently, because this is the career he's chosen. And in rebuttal, I said, they're attacking the Columbia-educated Holocaust, son of Holocaust survivors, who's devoted his entire career to helping people with trauma and grief, suggesting that he's the wrong witness to comment on that because that's his area of expertise. Well, who did they want us to call to talk about trauma and grief? An auto mechanic? So we went at that, and then they basically, you know, accused Marielle of lying or exaggerating her symptoms. So we kind of tied that into the whole theme of, you have a constitutional right to do this, but you get attacked for it. And it's really, really hard to come forward and to be the plaintiff and to bring a case like this. But if people aren't willing to come forward and to take the abuse that they dole out against you, then conduct like what we had here will just continue to go on, and it'll go on and on because nobody will ever be willing to stand up for it. So that was kind of the approach we took to their, what Merrill accurately described as the death by a thousand cuts defense closing.
Amazing. So a consistent theme throughout this trial is that you both have an amazing way of just having real talk about what the defenses are, what they're actually trying to say, and exposing them for the weak or fraudulent defenses they are. That's pretty awesome. Okay, taking a step back. This is one of the first opportunities a civil lawyer in Maine has had to do attorney voir dire. How'd you make that happen? And you touched upon it, but how did it all play out?
So this has been a culmination of what's probably been about a decade long struggle that I've had to get the judges in Maine to permit lawyer voir dire. So for years, I would give speeches on it at CLEs in Maine. I would talk to anybody who would be willing to listen to me. By the end of that process, we're probably in 2018 or so, I had been meeting with a group of judges on a variety of issues, part of a working group on voir dire, I think, that convened at my request. And ultimately, we were able to get the court to adopt a change in our rule of civil procedure. It's Rule 47 that governs how voir dire is managed in our superior courts. And although they wouldn't agree to create an absolute right for lawyer voir dire, the new rule compared to the old one makes it pretty clear that under, you know, if certain basic threshold requirements are satisfied, that the judge should be, it actually says shall allow either supplemental jury questionnaire or attorney directed voir dire of a panel. So that was a really big rule change. And so we filed a motion but unfortunately the rule change came into effect right as the pandemic was coming in. And so after the rule changed, there was really no opportunity to take advantage of it to do voir dire. So we've been living under the regime of new rule for 3 years, but no one's actually used it yet. And so now in cases that are going to trial, we file motion for attorney voir dire under the new rule and point out the evolution of the rule and that it's specifically intended to permit more robust voir dire and involvement of counsel. And so this was really the first opportunity to use the new rule, and the judge, you know, agreed and granted us voir dire. But it really does still feel like we're on a probationary status. You know, you're definitely on eggshells. I tried to be, you know, what they're really worried about, of course, is they hear this specter of horrible possible things that could happen. You're going to be trying your case in voir dire. You're going to be tainting the jury. You're going to be doing things like that to try to get out ahead of the evidence. You know, and I always say, you know, I'm not going to talk about our case at all. And we didn't. We didn't talk about our case at all. But so I think that part, you know, went well in the sense we didn't go outside the boundaries of what was appropriate. The judges, you know, they don't really understand what voir dire is in a state where it's not routinely done. They don't really understand that lawyers like us are trying to find jurors that can be open-minded and fair, despite all their superficial answers to things that our judges for decades or centuries have just accepted as gospel, right? Like, yes, I can be fair and impartial, when we all know many can't. So in order to elicit that, as you know, you have to give them permission to talk, and then you have to listen a lot, and you have to develop an environment where people will talk. And that whole thing creates a different dynamic than anybody in Maine is used to seeing in voir dire, where it's usually just a very rigid, is there anybody here who, you know, fill in the blank? If so, stand up, state your juror number. And it's very regimented normally like that. So afterwards, the judge seemed fine with it. He granted us 30 minutes. We took 40. And afterwards, he said, you know, I felt like I was watching a talk show, like, you know, Jerry Springer or something. No, that's kind of how they react to this. Dr. Phil, yeah. It's like, you know, you'd think they could engage in a slightly more, it's just a comment on the process and how it looks, right? As opposed to, wow, we have some jurors that are really opening up and sharing information that we never would have learned but for this.
Right.
Because, and I get it, because the judges, to them, the information doesn't matter to them. It's not important. Their job is just to pick a jury and to be able to say that, you know, they check boxes and then it can be fair and impartial. But for the lawyers on both sides of the case that actually depend on these people to make important decisions that affect the lives of our clients, and I think that's true for both sides. It really does matter who these people are, as you well know. So, you know, I hope it's the first of many opportunities to do this. It's still very precarious. The same judge we have in this case is likely going to preside over my next trial, which is a Med-Mal trial scheduled probably for a couple of weeks in January. And my hope is he won't think this is too Dr. Phil to allow it again. But, and I will say, I mean, just for our listeners, Rahul was so generous in providing me with the transcripts, actual video of the voir dire you did in your recent Las Vegas case. Both Merrill and I watched it. Merrill was the one who prepared and made the cause objections. So I wanted her to watch so she could get an understanding of how it worked and then also watch how you guys made your objections. And I certainly plagiarized your voir dire. And probably the first, you know, several minutes of it were verbatim what you did. I didn't use the speed dating line because it just didn't, I didn't think it fit me well. And I did change the carrot cake and what do you have? Carrot cake and lemon cake, right?
Lemon cake.
Yeah. I changed that. I'm very proud of my version of that. You want to hear what it is?
Absolutely.
So I what I said to the jury was, I want you to imagine that there's a song competition, sort of like maybe The Voice or American Idol. And you have to, someone says, you know, Ben, you're going to be the judge. And there's two songs that are being sung. One is a 80s style rock ballad, and the other one is a hip hop song. And I said, you know, before I sign up to do that, I think it's fair for me to let everybody here know, I just don't love hip hop. I want to like it. I recognize that the talent of the artists, and my kids love it. You know, if they turn it on the radio or they play it, I'm willing to listen, and I'll listen to a few songs before I make them turn it off. But I just don't love it. And, you know, is there anybody here who thinks that it would be wrong for me to, you know, disclose that and tell you about that before you choose me to judge these two songs? And I like that example, because then I went on to say, you know, also I recognize that that may make me not very cool, especially in the eyes of my kids, it does. But I'm not here to be cool. You know, I'm here to tell you what I honestly think about it. And also some people may say, well, that's not really politically correct, you know? But again, this isn't about political correctness. So it's about being brutally honest. And the brutal honesty is I just don't love hip hop as much as maybe I'd like to try. And I think that worked well.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. There, I could see maybe certain jury pools where that you might not want to go there. But in a rural Maine jury, blue collar, former mill town community, there's probably no danger in offending too many people about that. But I kind of like it because there is sort of there's a little bit more to that than simply the taste preference, because it does build in some cultural, how cool are you? How hip are you? How politically correct are you? In a way that's probably okay and doesn't cross a line. So anyway, it worked for me. I couldn't do the cakes. I couldn't do the pies because I love all kinds of cakes and all kinds of pies. My kids basically say, their line is, Dad'll eat anything, which isn't 100% true, but it's mostly true. So it's hard for me to find a food I don't like, to use that example.
Well, you've just created a cause challenge for me, because I'm judging you for not liking hip hop. I mean, that's just bothersome.
Well, you're younger than me, Rahul. I'm sure you love, you know, you're oh, much hipper goodness. Than I am.
Well, that's fantastic. One last question, and then I think we will wrap up for today. But it's been a couple of years almost now since we've started this podcast. We had some amazing guests on, obviously Keith Mitnick with the apple pie cherry pie, which I made lemon cake, and and Carrot Cake, and you've made hip hop and 80s bands. But are there other things that you've done in this time period or you've learned from, which you tried to implement in your trial here?
Yeah, I thought a lot about that because it felt really weird going back into the courtroom, to be honest. I was very nervous about it because it's been so long and 51 years old. And there's a difference between being in your mid to late 40s and moving into your 50s. It just, things change. And I started a new firm. So I left a very comfortable, highly paid job with lots of security and safety nets to start over again. And, you know, in some ways in my mind, I'd ratcheted it up that a lot was riding on it, even though now the reality is probably wasn't, but I felt like that. One of the biggest things that I found in going back into the courtroom with this long gap was I've allowed myself to change the way I think about trials. I think a lot of it has been spending time with people like you and other people, learning from other people, just having the space to think and not have to prepare cases, you know, one after the other for the courtroom. But what I've let go of things that I used to think were important or I used to do and sort of re-envisioned how I want to try a case from the ground up. So I don't feel like I need to do certain things anymore that I might have felt like I needed to do before because that's how I was trained or that's what I had always done. And it was just a real sense of freedom. I mean, one example was giving up doing the opening, giving it to Meryl. She did a wonderful job with the opening, by the way, and really set the tone for the whole trial. But it's not something I would have done before. I really focused my energy on doing a closing, which in the past had sort of been an afterthought. I would prepare my opening. I would think, well, during the case, I'll take notes and then I'll cobble together the closing and just sort of riff. And that could be fine, but in this case, I really had a strategy and a plan for that and did a number of things that I just had never done and did them differently. And it felt good to do that, to give up some of the orthodoxies that I had done before and just kind of start fresh from a clean slate. So I think the 3 years off has been really great for that reason. I'm really looking forward to future trials now, because when you start to let go of some of that stuff, it can be more fun. I mean, the closing really was just a series of arguments that connected to the case, obviously, but just things I really believed in and stated in a way that was personal to me and authentic and not worrying again about what's the right way to do it or the wrong way to do it, as people might have, you know, taught or learned over time. So I don't know. It's, you know, it's hard to draw any broad conclusions from a single data point. And this is obviously a single data point, but it felt good, felt right. And I really value the growth. I feel like I've had a lot of growth is really the bottom line in the last 3 years, because of the opportunity to have space and removal and to broaden my horizons by meeting a lot of great lawyers like you and learning from you and from the others we've had on this show, but, you know, also in other spheres as well.
Awesome. Well, congratulations, Meryl, to you and to Ben and to your clients on getting a righteous result for a righteous case. And thank you for sharing it with everyone.
Thank you, Raul.
Thank you.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.